The House Public Safety Committee will come to order. Welcome back, members. We have two bills on the agenda today. We actually have three bills on the agenda today and one informational bill. First of all, since we do have a quorum present, I would like a motion to approve the minutes of April 9th, April 10th, and October 9th, 2013, which was a joint hearing.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal makes that motion. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion prevails. Just a couple of announcements. I haven't had an opportunity yet to meet with Representative Cornish, the lead Republican on the committee, but we'll be having some discussions about this rather short session. It is the intent of the chair to have an omnibus bill this year. I would just caution members, given the shortness of the session, to get your bills in, file them quickly. If you want a hearing on them, let us know, and make sure that you get your fiscal notes in. Also, we have a new page. Who's our page? Can you just introduce yourself and tell us where you're from and.
I'm Trevor Bobble, from Mankato. Just moved up to St. Paul in the last few months.
Okay. Well, welcome, Trevor. Thank you. Okay. Is there any business I'm not covering yet? All right, then. We'll go with Representative Rosenthal. You have the first bill, House File 2141. Representative Rosenthal moves House File 2141, and then Representative Rosenthal, you have an amendment, the A1.
The A1 amendment.
To
yes,
get it in the shape you want it. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill has a little bit of history in this committee. In 2009, I was the chief author of the bill that extended the time that a person could be charged for domestic abuse without a warrant from 12 to 24 hours. And that was brought by the Hennepin County attorney at the time, or prosecutors at the time. And it really did work for a little while and had a great effect. But as we know, people change, and once they understand the rules and the ramifications, they tend to hide longer. And so at this time, while the 24 hours did work for a little while, we're finding across the state that it is no longer having the effect that we had hoped, as it did when it first was enacted. So basically what this bill does, it takes away the 24 hours and allows for the arrest with no time limit at the time. It brings it into alignment with other offenses that are misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. And this is something that's very important to me. It was brought by the Battered Women Association and law enforcement, and I appreciate that. And I do have some testifiers, and I'd like them to have some chance to speak to the bill.
Okay, who would like to go first?
Chair Paymar?
Ms. Moses, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Paymar, and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Moses, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. There have been 38 domestic violence homicides in 2013. Which have heightened public concern and mobilized Minnesotans to action. In response to the murders, we held multiple convenings with over 100 legislators, law enforcement, prosecutors, advocates, and community members in the summer and fall of 2013. We discussed what policy changes were needed to improve victim safety. Out of those convenings, 23 ideas to improve our responses to domestic violence were proposed. A handful of those ideas involved legislative changes. This bill is a result of those convenings. Let me illustrate the problem that gone on arrivals pose with a case example, Gloria's case. Unfortunately, her case is one of many. The first time Gloria's partner abused her, she called the police, but he escaped before the police could arrive. He was purposefully evading law enforcement because he knew that police only had 24 hours to make a warrantless arrest. Then, 24 hours later, he would return and abuse her again. This happened several times in 1 week, and he always escaped before officers arrived. Eventually, Gloria and her son had to flee their home to a domestic violence shelter because law enforcement did not have sufficient time to apprehend and arrest the abuser before a warrant was obtained. Moving misdemeanor domestic abuse crimes in probable cause warrantless arrests in category with other domestic violence types type crimes helps victim safety. Now I'd like to turn it over to Chief Paul Snow.
Chief Snow, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Paymar and members of the committee. My name is Paul Schnell, and I am the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood Police Department, and I'm here today testifying in support of House File 2141. To improve victim safety and effectively hold perpetrators accountable, law enforcement needs sufficient time to apprehend and arrest domestic violence perpetrators when they flee the scene of a domestic violence crime. The current challenge is that when law enforcement has probable cause to believe that a misdemeanor abuse has occurred, domestic abuse has occurred, we are not always able to make a warrantless arrest within the current 24-hour time frame because the suspect has fled the scene. The problem in such cases is that 24 hours is not long enough for law enforcement to either locate or arrest the subject or get the case submitted for issuance of an arrest warrant before the abuser can strike again. This is a concern in both greater Minnesota and the metro area alike. Across our state, when misdemeanor or domestic assault offenses occur on weekends, near weekends, or on holidays, 24 hours may not provide enough time for law enforcement to locate and arrest that perpetrator. Take, for instance, a domestic assault that occurs at 9 p.m. on a Friday night, and the suspect has fled before law enforcement arrives. While probable cause was established at the time of the response on Friday night, if the abuser returns to the victim's home at 11 p.m. on Saturday, that batter cannot be arrested for the underlying original offense. Obviously, this lack of ability to act reduces victim safety and undermines confidence in our criminal justice system. In some greater Minnesota communities, the current time limitations and lower levels of staffing and longer distance of travel to apprehend and arrest perpetrators can create significant challenges. In the metro area, where higher case and call volumes are ever-present realities for law enforcement, 24 hours is simply not long enough for the case to be submitted and a complaint warrant issued. Under current law, violations of protection orders and domestic violence offenses are not subject to a time limit for a warrantless arrest, yet misdemeanor domestic abuse is limited to 24 hours. The differing time limits for making probable cause, warrantless arrests, and domestic violence situations can create confusing and disjointed response schemes for law enforcement and domestic violence victims alike. As a result, when there is a domestic violence situation, the 24-hour time limit has become the default, meaning in some cases it is misapplied and used in non-felony violations of orders for protection, along with felony-level domestic violence cases. House File 2141 would provide a remedy to the problem identified in the case described by the previous witness, the problem Gloria faced. This can be done by extending the time period for probable cause warrant arrest for creating consistency with other domestic violence-related offenses in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for your consideration of this bill and my testimony, and would be willing to stand for any questions you or the committee may have.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I sit on the Crow Wing County Sexual Assault Services Board of Directors for about the last 8 years. And so we have seen a pattern of much, much greater abuse offenses in our area. Even recently, Ms. Moses, you and I have talked about, Representative Rosenthal and Chief, thank you, all of three of you, for bringing this forward. We talked about a case in Crow Wing County that is a felony right now for attempted murder, that I think had this law been enacted previously, may have been prevented from escalating to that point. Mm-hmm. And Chief, you mentioned that as well. And so members, the perpetrators know the system, they play the system, and this, in my opinion, is a way to help the victims. And wouldn't it be nice if we got to zero case of domestic abuse? But this is an attempt, this could be an attempt to at least significantly decrease the escalation of more serious crimes. So I would ask for your support in passing what I think is a very, very good piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moses, if we delete the language on line 2.21, 2.22, does that mean that law enforcement has the ability to or make an arrest in perpetuity?
No.
Can you explain then how, where in the bill it...
And you're referring, Chair Paymar, you're referring to the change in the title?
No.
No, referring to the page 2 of the bill.
Basically, Mr. Chair, I believe that's the case.
Representative Rosenthal? So it isn't perpetuity?
Chair Paymar, committee members, it would be, at the present time, that would be the case until such time as the case would be charged out by an appropriate prosecuting authority, similar to what may happen in felony-level cases or even in misdemeanor order for protection violations.
Representative Cornish.
Representative Paymar and Representative Rosenthal, I don't really think that that's going to survive the whole process on to passage, and I haven't come up with any figure yet, but the history of that, I think, has been, what, 8 hours, then 12 hours, then 24 hours. It's been increment, it's been increased. It's 1978 was 4 hours, 1995, 12 hours, and 2009, 24 hours. Personally, I was thinking about a figure about 72 hours to get through the weekend or something like this, but I would highly doubt that we would go from increments to perpetuity. So that's just a suggestion.
Mr. Chair?
Who's Representative Rosenthal?
Representative Cornish, I was swinging for the fences, but I do agree with you that there is some time limit that needs to be placed on that, and we are going to work on that and come up with one that will protect victims and also protect innocent people.
Representative Schoen. I see Aviva Breen is in the audience. I could ask her to come up and give us an historical analysis. weren't you around when we did this? So this is sort of a work in progress on the time limit. Is that, I understand. Any other questions?
Chair, that's correct.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Paymar, Chief. Can you tell me how long it usually takes after a domestic assault to end up bring the reports to the county attorneys or your local attorney and obtain a arrest warrant?
Chief Schnell.
Chair, Representative, this is one of those situations where I think, you know, to Representative Cornish's comment, I think this is one of those situations where we, on that Friday night situation that I cited, typically that case would be prepared and packaged for the prosecuting authority on Monday, probably Monday morning sometime, and brought, and then usually sometime on Monday when the prosecutors have a chance to get that. Again, this is one of those caseload issues that a complaint warrant could be issued perhaps late in the day or early on Tuesday. Obviously, we can see that where this can become problematic. So some period of time would may be very appropriate to sunset this, but recognizing that those weekends and holidays in particular create great challenges across Minnesota and for our prosecutors.
Representative Johnson.
Chief, now, if you're not aware, I'm a retired deputy sheriff. I've handled many domestics, and they're one of the worst calls that law enforcement goes to. Because no matter what you, no matter either the victim or the perpetrator, somebody's always mad at you, and you always have to be watching your back. Because I've actually been fighting a gentleman who was assaulting his wife, and she came up to start assaulting me because I was fighting her husband. One question I have, and we dealt with it in my department. You'd have a domestic at 6 o'clock in the evening. You have that 24-hour rule. I'd come back on my shift at 7 in the morning, I never even knew about the assault, and I ended up talking to the gentleman, ran into him on the street. But if went to it, they had a time limit and a warrant process, we get the list of warrants. We know who has warrants. With the current situation, how to get that information on, if you go to even at 72 hours, if the other officers in that department don't know what happened, they're not even going to, they could talk to them, not even know there was a situation to bring them to jail. So if we get a time limit and get to a search warrant or an arrest warrant, I think we'd be much better off.
Okay, are there any other questions? Representative Sean.
Mr. Chair and Chief Schnell, or any other subject matter experts in the audience on this issue or staff, how do felonies and gross misdemeanors compare in relation to the 24-hour notice? I know that, can we carry those into perpetuity, or does this language match what currently happens there? I guess, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is match the seriousness of how we feel about domestic violence and how we need to carry that on. So if staff can maybe give me an answer, is there a specific language that touches on timelines for those offenses as well?
Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair and members, actually it's in the bill, section 1. If you look down at paragraph C, line 1.19 and 1.20, when a person arrested has committed a felony, although not in the officer's presence, there is no time limit. And then if you can continue on to the next page, clauses 5, 6, and 7 discuss certain gross misdemeanor thefts. Clause 6 discusses misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor restraining orders and no contact orders. And clause 7, I'm not quite sure what that escape for gross misdemeanor escapes. So those would not have time limits.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think this just highlights, I think Representative Johnson made a good point that obviously getting to a warrant is going to be the point that we get to when we, I think Chief Schnell, Mr. Chair, if he could answer this. How long, when we enter someone in as just basically we want to pick up and hold, or the old attempt to locate, pick up and hold, how long does that last in our current system right now when it just originates from an agency before it expires automatically?
Chief Snell.
Chair PMR, Representative, I think there's many different departments who have different policies. Some places will go 24 hours to 36 hours, or up to 72 on probable cause pickups. But then obviously in those felony cases, they can extend. During my time in St. Paul, there were times when in felony cases we might have a probable cause pickup up for somebody as long as 30 days in some of these cases while we're waiting to try and investigate that case, although probable cause was clearly established.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Sean,
I think that 72-hour mark is pretty much a standard expiration that you'd have to renew that in the system. So it's a good guideline for investigators to continue that. So it's kind of semi-built into the systems that are in place. I think we highlight how serious domestic violence is and where it's at. I'd also ask for a roll call on this vote if we're going to vote on this bill.
Representative Schoen has asked for a roll call. Okay, we're going to. I want to know if there's anyone from the public that would like to comment in favor or in opposition to this bill. Please come up, sir. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Jones. I am director of Minnesota Parent Child Advocacy Center in North Minneapolis. I stand opposed to this bill with a for a number of reasons. There are a number of misdemeanor crimes where the alleged victim has made a false accusation against the perpetrator. Escalating this as a warrantless arrest is not necessary. The cops can go to a judge and ask them to do that, or the victim supposedly can go and ask for a restraining order and stop them. And if the offense is that bad, they should be removed from that house and go to a shelter for protection. But the bottom line is that you've got to protect both sides. And the continued erosion of the rights of the person that's accused is just unnecessary in a misdemeanor charge. Now, if it's a felony charge, I'm 100% with you. In 96, I, working as an intern in the House of Representatives, pushed a bill, the Martin Luther King Nonviolent Institutional Child Development Pilot Program, to assist children impacted by homicides and violence. And so I'm very much aware of domestic assaults being able to escalate into homicides and so on and so on. So I am very much concerned about the impact on society and the community. No community has been impacted greater by domestic violence and the homicides than the African American community. But at some point, we got to have a balance between the rights of the accused and the rights of the victim. Making this go open-ended is unnecessary, and it further creates a negative impact on the African-American community. I believe that the current practice of 24 hours is enough. If it's that bad, there are other tools that law enforcement can use to and the community has to protect that woman and that family, including helping them move out of that house to a safe place. Because if it's going to be that bad, they need to move. That's why we have safe houses. That's why we have these other tools. And then meanwhile, law enforcement can do what they need to do and keep that woman safe at the same time. So what happens if you put him under arrest and then you go to the court hearing and he gets released? He can still do the same thing if that's what he was bent on doing in the first place. So my concern is that at a misdemeanor charge, this is unnecessary.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jones. We have another testifier. If you keep your comments maybe to about 3 minutes, that'd be helpful. Okay. Please state your name for the record.
The name is Bill Ronan, and I'm a clinical social worker.
Very good. Thank you for being here.
I'll talk about a phenomenon that's associated with this, and touched on it. I call it the big lie. There's probable cause, which the officer presumably gets from the supposed victim. And the probable cause in this case is that he's told domestic violence has occurred. It is assumed that no one would lie about something like that, just like they didn't lie about false memory syndromes and abuse in childhood 30 years prior. It would be just too big of a lie. The big lie means the bigger the lie, the more it will be believed, because it is assumed. It is just too big of a lie, while smaller lies are known quite well to most average liars. But big lies are beyond the comprehension of your average liar, so that doesn't sink in with the majority of the public. Intentional false allegations, which can be done to get the kids, the house, the car, citizenship, motivations are very strong, are the big lies. They can lead our family court justice system, if you still want to call it a justice system, to do terrible things without any consequences. Just having the allegations greatly damages the innocent who have been accused. And I personally know of false allegations of threatened terrible abuse coming from the domestic violence shelter Sojourner. The prosecution of false allegations, according to our state court administrator, is 0.00164%. That begs out for prosecutorial misconduct. to think that lying doesn't happen, but abuse does, begs credibility for every thinking person. It seems clear to me that false allegations are functionally never dealt with. Please do not make the situation even worse by enacting this law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else? Representative Simon.
Just a quick question for one or both testifiers. If I understand it correctly, the opposition is rooted mostly, the two gentlemen who just testified in opposition. My question is whether your opposition is rooted in the application to misdemeanors, or is it rooted in the sort of open-ended in perpetuity part of the bill? In other words, if this were limited to felonies, or if there were a cap placed, say a 72-hour cap, would that change your view of the bill?
If Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Jones,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Simon.
I think this going on in perpetuity is just inappropriate for a misdemeanor. Second, if the perpetrator was really as bad as that, we would have some repeated history of domestic abuse and unresolution issues. And if that's there and it's repeated, if it said something like, well, if this is a repeated situation, we'll allow it to extend. But for a first accused person with no history of this, it's outrageous. I don't believe it's necessary. And at second, I do believe that if someone is that terrorized, leaving that family in that particular place is not a good idea, period. And if we're going to move forward, we have safety net stuff to help that family to go to a safe place, and they need to go there. Because extending it more than 24 hours, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Do you want the other testifier to answer also?
If he wishes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ronan, do you want to testify?
I think just because the lie is bigger, meaning felony status, the protections for the person being falsely accused needs to be taken into account. There's just too much motivation. A book written on the psychopath next door, this woman who teaches at Harvard, says it's 1 in 25, and she says the only sign you'll ever get from a psychopath is that they're asking for your sympathy. The domestic violence industry is like graduate school for sociopaths and psychopaths because they do it very well, and it's across the board. So, yes, I think that our whole system needs to be revised. The way it's working is destroying innocent people who do not have a chance. Getting that on your record keeps you from getting a job. It's just terrible things. So, yes, I think that our justice system needs to aim at something that resembles justice. And this innocent until proven guilty illusion needs to be brought into focus.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, did you have a question? Members, we have three other bills to deal with today. This bill is also being referred to the Judiciary Committee. So some of the issues around the time frame here, I would hope Representative Rosenthal will get dealt with before it gets to Representative Hillstrom's committee.
Mr. Chair, they absolutely will. And to Representative Simon's questions and Mr. Jones' concerns, we've thought about it, and I'm concerned about the same thing. And this was never intended to be open-ended. But we want to make sure that these people that are being abused are given the best chance to seek safety as they can. And so I do give you my word that we will work to find the right balance, and it will not be open-ended, and your comments will be taken into consideration.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Rosenthal took care of much of what I was going to ask about with his comments. Members, I just want to make sure that members are aware that many of the felony domestic violence cases that are prosecuted are because you have prior misdemeanor offenses. So it's, in many instances, the same behavior that would convict you of a misdemeanor domestic assault that then is graduated because you have multiple instances of it that then create it to be a felony domestic assault. And so I do think that it's reasonable to have additional time when it comes time to get these folks who leave the scene. And I appreciate that you're going to work on how much time that should be and what the situation should look like.
We have Representatives Schoen, Mullery, and Cornish, and then we're going to vote.
Mr. Chair, just since we're moving along in that fashion, I'll withdraw the roll call.
Representative Schoen withdraws his motion for a roll call. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very quickly, I agree partially with Mr. Jones because he's from our community, and both sides in our community suffer greatly on this issue. And so we have to look at both sides. I'm going to vote with you today, but there's got to be a limit on the time that's extremely reasonable. And what I would like to see is, since this does affect communities like ours a lot, I'd like to somehow build in a review by a department of the effects that come from this on each side. And that's just a suggestion as you go on. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Just a quick comment. I'm co-author and I support your bill wholeheartedly, you know that, and the only reason I brought up the 72-hour is just that I think it'd be a better bill with that. And I just wanted to object some of the testimony to hint that women lie carte blanche in these instances, and we run into a problem. We start believing that, and with less protection of women, there's no reason why a woman should have to move out of her house to avoid being assaulted. It's another thing, and we start not believing kids when they tell us about, you know, being molested. We run into a problem there. We got to start believing people. And there's always going to be lies. There's going to be people that report false crimes against police officers, against men, against women. We can't solve that. But I think we've got to err on the side of the woman that's being beaten to death here. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. I would echo that. And I would also say that a lot of these misdemeanor domestic assault cases end up in homicides if we don't intervene properly. And the 25 women that were killed last year are some of those may have been prevented. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. I know you'll work and get it in good shape by the time it gets to Representative Hillstrom's committee. Now we need a motion from you. Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 2141, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you,
Thank
Representative
you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll leave it to the committee members to figure out how to share that.
Representative Urusa, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 2142.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have an oral amendment to begin with. If we look at page 2 on line 1, before the word release, I would like to insert the words or after, so that it would then read upon or after release from.
Would you repeat that, please?
Page 2, line 1, before the word release, insert the words or after. So the phrase would then read upon or after release from.
Okay, so we'll just, the chair will incorporate the words on line 2.1, delete, release, and insert or after.
No, do not delete release. Just the insertion.
Just the insertion of or after. Okay. All right. So all those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill provides the victims of domestic violence and crimes of violence the right to request and receive the location of a convicted offender's residence upon the offender's release from the Department of Corrections. The intent is that the victim should also have the right to, the information that would be released would be the zip code of the offender's post-incarceration residence while the offender is still under Department of Corrections supervision. It would allow the prohibition of the location information if it would endanger the victim, the offender, or the public, or if the offender is no longer under supervision, or if Corrections does not have that location information. It also classifies all identifying information regarding the victim, including but not limited to notification provided by the Commissioner of Corrections or its designee as private data on individuals accessible only to the victim. Just walking through the bill, on lines 120 through 122, it describes what crimes are included. Those sections, section 609.02 includes qualified domestic violence offenses, and section 624.712 is crimes of violence. And we have today Rebecca Moses from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and Sergeant Randy McAllister of Washington County to testify.
Ms. Moses, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee members again. I'll state my name is Rebecca Moses, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm testifying in support of House File 2142. In my testimony about House File 2141 earlier in this hearing, I referred to the 38 domestic violence homicides in 2013 and how those murders have catalyzed Minnesotans to action. This bill is also a direct outcome of the convenings that were held in the summer and fall. So what barriers to safety does HF 2142 seek to solve? Under current law, victims of domestic violence have the right to know the date of an offender's release. But for the majority of convictions related to domestic violence, current statute does not provide victims a right to notification of a convicted offender's post-incarceration residence. This is problematic because many domestic violence victims live in fear as an offender's release date approaches. Lack of location information also endangers domestic violence victims because safety plans are less accurate. A safety plan looks drastically different if the offender lives hours away versus minutes. I'd like to share the story of a domestic violence survivor and how lack of access to information about the offender's post-incarceration location posed serious safety risks. Janae arrived at a domestic violence advocacy program office frightened and seeking assistance. Years ago, when she was pregnant with their child, her intimate partner brutally strangled and assaulted her. He was convicted of domestic assault by strangulation and was incarcerated. Even as he was behind bars, Janae still didn't feel safe. She feared he would find her when he got out. So she moved to a different part of Minnesota, seeking safety and looking for a fresh start. As his release date approached, she was nervous about where in Minnesota he would be released to. Even though she had relocated her entire life, she worried. Would he be released 5 minutes or 5 hours away? Would he find her? Would he hurt her and her children again? Janae knew when he would be released, but she didn't know where. His release date arrived, and the very next day he was outside Janae's home. He had found her and began to stalk her. In response to his stalking behavior, Janae sought help at the local advocacy program. In collaboration with the criminal justice system, they assisted her and her children to find safety. HF 2142 could help victims like Janae proactively access information crucial to their well-being. Thank you to the committee, and I pass it on to Sergeant Tuff.
Sergeant, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sergeant Randy McAllister. I investigate and manage domestic violence and stalking cases out of Cottage Grove in Washington County. I am testing in support of HF 2142. As an expert on target violence and stalking with 16 years of law enforcement experience, including instructing courses on stalking for the National Stalking Resource Center, we know that proactive approaches can be the most helpful to victim safety. There are often simple steps that can be taken to be proactive before violence occurs or continues to occur, instead of solely relying on reactive steps only after violence has occurred. For instance, victim access to location information for convicted offenders is a simple and proactive step that can be taken to increase victim safety. Proactive steps are even more crucial in cases where there's a history of abuse, because we also know that there is increased risk for victims of prior abuse. For instance, Janae's case is a perfect example. We know that there was prior abuse because of the conviction. In fact, as soon as he was released, he found her and began to stalk her, which is a telltale sign of increased risk and danger. With location information to domestic violence victims, we can proactively work with victims like Janae to address safety planning before serious violence occurs. Please pass HF 2142. Thank you.
Are there any questions of the testifiers? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moses, in the case with Janae that you cited, did the Department of Corrections intentionally release Janae's abuser directly into her community, or?
My understanding,
Ms. Moses.
I apologize, Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh. My understanding is that he was that she does not know that information because she was not she could not get information about where he was going to reside.
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, so my question is, how on the sheet that's passed out, it says a safety plan looks drastically different if the offender lives hours away versus minutes. How does the safety plan look different?
Sure,
Ms. Moses.
I apologize, Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh. It really looks quite different. I was a domestic violence advocate before I began doing policy work for the coalition. And if you have someone who's going to be living 5 minutes away, where you're going to drive, how you're going to drive around, kind of what you're going to be alert to is going to look very different than if he's living 5 hours away. So it's a huge difference in terms of precautions that are taken to stay safe.
Tim Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm wondering if you, you can't tell these individuals, they serve their time in prison, supposedly they've paid their debt to society based upon how they were adjudicated. You don't know if they were rehabilitated in prison or not. And if they get out and perhaps their sentence wasn't long enough and they decide that they're going to go after Janae again, is the location of where they're released going to make a difference to Janae? And if they release this guy to a halfway house on the east side of St. Paul or North Minneapolis, which is where I think a lot of them are, it's true. And Janae lives in Moorhead. He could be in Moorhead within 5 hours of his release, right?
Ms. Moses.
Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh, that is correct. This is one small proactive step that can be taken. In the end, we know that if someone feels entitled to perpetrate violence, they will perpetrate violence. But we know that victims can work, again, with law enforcement, with corrections, to proactively safety plan to avoid that violence. But you're absolutely correct. This is one small proactive step.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we have somebody here from the Department of Corrections?
Is there anyone here from the department that can that would like to that can answer a question?
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Lonergan, Government Relations from the Department of Corrections, and I have Lydia with me from the Victims Unit.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Lydia Newland. I'm the Director of Victim Assistance at the Department of Corrections, and I'm responsible for all victim notification processes and policies that take place there.
Representative Simonson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming up. I appreciate it. My question has to do on the second page of the bill, specifically starting with line 2.7. And what we're doing here is we're describing scenarios where the DOC may not or might not choose to release information to the victim's request. And I'm just trying to get a practical sense of how you would apply item number 3, which starts on 2.7, when we say that the Department of Corrections reasonably believes that disclosure of the zip code creates a risk to the victim, offender, or public safety. I mean, I could envision a scenario where that might happen just about every time. But I'm just trying to get a practical sense of how you would apply that language.
I didn't catch your last name again. Could you?
Newlin, N-E-W-L-I-N.
Newlin, okay. Ms. Newlin?
Chair Paymer, I'm sorry, Representative?
Simonson.
It's a great question. I'm not exactly sure. I can, because this is something new to what we currently do. We provide all victims who request notification the information that we're required to provide them by statute. And so we don't differentiate at this point in time who we do provide notification to or information to and who we don't. We completely go 100% by statute and not by anything that would be decided on a case-by-case basis. The situation that I can think of that this might fall into is if we know that we have an offender who is at risk because there have been threats made against that offender by the victim or by somebody that is close to the victim. That might be a situation where there would be a decision to not disclose the information. But at this point in time, I have to be honest, I'm not exactly sure how this would be done.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I think I can wrap my head around the concept of that there might be a risk to the offender. But I'm just having a little bit of difficulty understanding when there might be a risk to the victim. And in this case, you know, the victim assumably would be reaching out, requesting the information from the DOC. And I could surmise, you know, just about every scenario where releasing that information might constitute a risk to the victim. So I'm just curious where the language came from. It doesn't sound like it came out of the DOC. Maybe the author knows the history of the language.
Representative Urusso.
I would defer that question back to Rebecca.
Ms. Moses. And then we have Representative Mullery, and then we're going to vote on the bill because we have two more bills to hear. And this bill is also going to the Judiciary Committee, so some of the questions that you're raising, we could try to get the answers to by then.
Chair
Ms.
Paymar.
Moses?
Chair Paymar and Representative Simonson. The reason that we included victim was that there may be a fact pattern that we can't conceive of right now where a victim receiving information could put her in danger. So we were trying to give the Department of Corrections sufficient leeway so that if a circumstance arise that we, again, can't foretell in this moment, they would have the opportunity to look at that on a case-by-case basis. So that was the intent.
Representative Simonson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And I won't take up any more time, but and I certainly support this bill, and I'll be voting in favor of it today. But perhaps, Representative, we can just work this out offline before you get to your next committee stuff.
Okay. Is it fine? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick question. On lines 2.3 and 2.4, if the department still has that, even though they're not under supervision, is there any reason you wouldn't give either that zip code or the last known zip code to the person? Or why is that automatically excluded totally?
Ms. Moses.
Chair Paymar, Representative Mullery, the reason that we added this line specifically is because we didn't want Department of Corrections to have to give information and be concerned about liability for sharing information for someone who is no longer being supervised or no longer on paper. And so that was to respect that potential concern.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Could we correct that concern by just abrogating our liability for that?
We actually had, in the very first draft, a line about liability. However, our understanding, again, is that it's blue-letter law that if someone performs a task in the course of their official duties that they wouldn't be liable. Again, we didn't want, we wanted victims to understand when Department of Corrections could and couldn't give them the information. And so again, that's why we included that. But again, we'd be willing to have conversations about this.
Okay. Representative Russo, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is, as we've noted, part of a package of quite a number of bills designed to take the steps we can take to help ensure safety for victims of domestic violence and to prevent recurrence of them. We do have a couple more committees to go through, so we can take note of the concerns that have been raised and work on that. And thank you for your consideration.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? This bill apparently does not need to go to the Judiciary Committee, nor does it need to go to the Civil Law Committee. Therefore, the chair will lay over House File 2142 for possible inclusion in the public omnibus public safety bill. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And this was not a question I wanted to raise, but for purposes of a future consideration, I'm just curious because in my district, there's a zip code that's about 12 square blocks. And up in some other members' district, there are zip codes that, you know, I don't know if I live in one end of it and maybe 20, 30 miles to the other end, and maybe it doesn't impact my safety plan as much. So I'd be curious of the breakdown of if this has a different effect in different parts of Minnesota. That's all.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Iruzzo.
We did have a discussion about that, and in my neighborhood, if you have the 9-digit zip code, that takes it down to part of my street. But one of the things that I think we can consider in that is that if you live in a more concentrated area, then your neighborhood is that more concentrated area. And if you live in an area that's more spread out, then all of your grocery store and schools and all of that are also more spread out. So it may scale appropriately with the distribution of people anyway. But I'm not sure if Ms. Moses had more to add to that.
Ms. Moses, real quickly, we're going to wrap up.
Chair Paymar, Representative Lesh, we actually did some research into the use of a 9-digit zip code to identify an address, and it's actually quite interesting that there isn't much free public data that allows you to go from a 9-digit zip code to an address. But what we did find is, for instance, I Googled my address without the apartment number, and what I found is literally in my apartment complex, every two apartments has a different 9-digit zip code. And so it does get pretty, you can figure out more or less where the person is for a safety plan in areas of high concentration. What that looks like in areas where there is less population density, I don't have a very good answer for you at this time, but would be willing to continue to discuss it.
Very good. Thank you both. House File 2142 is laid over. Next is Representative Hornstein, 2173. We have two bills left. If we have to go over a little bit of our time to make sure that we hear from all the testifiers, we will do that. Representative Hornstein, welcome to the committee. I don't think we've ever seen you here.
I know. It's kind of amazing. Thank you very much, Chairman Paymar, and I'm really appreciative of your hearing. This is an informational hearing, I understand, on House File 2173. And,
is this... 2173.
Good. I think we can proceed. I know there's a couple people that will testify, but let me present the bill briefly first, Mr. Chairman and members. So, first of all, I'm very honored to be carrying this bill. Very honored to be working with the Council on Black Minnesotans and allied organizations. I think the large turnout today indicates the level of interest in legislation such as this that deals with human rights issues. And, you know, we have an incredible history here in the state of Minnesota as a national leader in not only establishing human rights commissions, but, you know, addressing these issues in general. goes back to, you know, Roy Wilkins and Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale's work on the housing issues, equal housing, and just a rich tradition of civil rights and social justice activism, you know, in our state, throughout the state, not just in the metropolitan region. And I think this legislation just builds on that history. We stand on the shoulders of those civil rights giants when we talk about the need to address human rights issues. And so what House File 2173 does is takes a look at our current Department of Human Rights and its roles and responsibilities. I think updates them and makes them appropriate for the times and the different issues and challenges that we have. And the reason I wanted to start off with that history is that we've made incredible progress. You know, the fact that we have President Obama in town today, you know, of all days, you know, indicates some things that have taken place that people couldn't have dreamed of many, many years ago. But it also is a way for us to look at the fact that there's so much business that's undone when we talk about civil and human rights. And so this helps us go to that next level. And so I wanted to just give you some quick context for House File 2173 before we have our testifiers. And you know, the reason we're doing this is that there's the lack of resources for civil rights enforcement has worsened, and leaving us in a bit of a crisis mode when it comes to our human rights public sector response. And audits and disparity studies are showing huge underutilization of impacted groups, which indicate noncompliance with the administrative application of civil rights and equal opportunity laws. Many legal advocates and victims of discrimination are refusing to refer complaints to local and state civil rights enforcement departments because they're in a continuous state of transition. There's a backlog of complaints, and there's unclear enforcement policies. And so the enforcement approach for the Department of Human Rights has gotten to the point that ballot initiatives were allowed to come to a vote that would constitutionalize prejudice and put restrictions on ability citizens to vote. The Department of Human Rights hasn't received a net increase in funding for nearly 20 years, and that's why we have these funding provisions in the bill. And Statute 363 allows for the DHR commissioner to only give priority to three of its administrative functions. So what we want to do is to provide that needed increase in funding. We want to increase proactive enforcement, provide for expanded administrative capacity, take the cap off commissioner duties, and establish a committee to study the process for implementing the UN's International Covenant to End All Forms of Racial Discrimination, that's known as the CERD, and how to deploy that United Nations Declaration for Women and Housing Rights in Minnesota proper. So, again, we're taking some of this some of these directives nationally and internationally and seeing how they can be impactful here in the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chairman, whether you want to have questions from the committee or have the testimony, I'm available for any and all functions here.
Why don't we take the testimony first, and then we'll see if members have questions. So if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Pema and other esteemed representatives of the House Committee on Judiciary and Finance and Policy, my name is Fatima Lawson, and I am the Vice Chair of the Council on Black Minnesotans and also the Chair of the Human Rights Committee of the Council. I am grateful for the opportunity to address you this morning concerning House File 2173, a bill to increase the duties and funding of the Department of Human Rights. Joining me today are Amari Berhi and Tamara Martin, who will be giving you some practical as a testimony of what we're talking about. I'll keep my comments very short, and I'll be happy to answer questions. As you know, Minnesota legislature empowered the Council on Black Minnesotans to ensure that people of African heritage fully and effectively participate in and equitably benefit from the political, social, and economic resources, policies, and procedures of the state. Today, approximately 320,000 Minnesotans indicate that their race is black or black along with another race. There are 76,400 black immigrants living in Minnesota, representing 23 African nations. When the first significant number of blacks arrived in the free state of Minnesota, they essentially had nothing. Today, black Minnesotans contribute the following assets to our great state: strong cultural diversity, $3 billion in consumer spending alone and power, operate over 12,000 business enterprises with almost $1 billion in sales, employing about 10,000 people and generating annual payrolls of $258 million. They export almost $200 million to African countries annually and expect to generate lifetime earnings of an estimated $388 billion, with projected total tax payments in Minnesota of $28 billion over their lifetime. We can do better, and we definitely want to do better to contribute to this great state of Minnesota. The Council has engaged in intensive qualitative and quantitative information gathering within our community to learn what is needed from a public policy standpoint in order to help our assets and contribute more to the great state of Minnesota. These engagements have led to the development of community-driven proposals for legislation that we believe move our people forward with new ideas, innovation, and energy that provides a direction to address the socioeconomic and sociopolitical challenges that Minnesotans face on a daily basis. These proposals take our community beyond constructs, simple tolerance, and appreciation, appreciating diversity, to practicing allophilia. One of the community-driven solutions that engaged us in this proposal is the human rights legislation that we're discussing today. By law, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has established an advisory committee in each of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. The committees are composed of state citizens who serve without compensation. The committees advise the Commission on civil rights issues in their states and are within the Commission's jurisdiction. Highlights from the Minnesota Commission hearings in 2011 are as follows. The lack of resources for civil rights enforcement in the state has worsened, just as our representative Ernestine said earlier. Audits and disparity studies are showing huge underrepresentation of minority groups, which indicate non-compliance with the administrative application of civil rights and equal opportunity laws. The Department of Human Rights hasn't received a net increase in funding for 15 years. Minnesota Statute 363 allows the Department of Human Rights Commissioner to only give priority to three of its administrative functions. These highlights do not, match the values of and spirit of Minnesota. Remember, Minnesota's history reflects a strong commitment to human rights. Her commitment to human rights dates back to her origins. Minnesota entered the Union as a free state and was among the first to answer the call to fight in the Civil War. Between 1877 and 1947, 8 anti-segregation laws were passed, reversing Jim Crow laws and giving minorities full access to public school, transportation, and other public facilities. In 1867, Minnesota established a state board of immigration to persuade potential settlers to move to our state, and by the end of the decade, 65% of Minnesotan residents were either immigrants or children of immigrants. Minnesota continues to be the choice of relocation for many immigrants from Laos, Somalia, Liberia, Iraq, etc. This is the state where in 1843, Martha Ripley opened Maternity Hospital, a woman-owned and operated hospital, provided a safe childbirth experience for women, including those who were shunned and abandoned. This state produced great civil rights icons like Nellie Stone Johnson, Vice President Herbert Humphrey, Vice President Walter Mondale, Roy Wilkins, Senator Paul Wellstone, among many others. In keeping with Minnesota's history and in the spirit of those who came before us, I humbly urge you to support this bill. Thank you in advance for your support of this important issue, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you, Dr. Lawson, for your testimony.
Who's You're next? Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tamara Martin. Thank you for giving me time to speak this morning. My purpose in being here is to support funding for increased human rights and civil rights enforcement in our state. I am a social worker, a mother, and a daughter of this great state of Minnesota. I'd like to say that I have a full-time job practicing in the career that I love, but that is not possible because I was wrongly terminated from my job 1 year ago. I was treated inequitably, humiliated, belittled, and threatened when I was able to bear up under the pressure and continue to perform. False testimony was used to cause the loss of my employment. It is humbling sharing this with you in such a public manner, but I can move past momentary discomfort if my story will have a broader impact. After I lost my job, I reached out to many sources for assistance. I filed a complaint with my employer's Office of Equity and Diversity, but after being passed from one person to the next with no resolution, I decided to file my complaint with the Department of Human Rights. I also sought legal assistance. I reached out to the Council of Black Minnesotans. I contacted the mayor's office, the governor's office, and offices of several state representatives. I sought assistance from my union. I sought assistance from community advocates and members of the clergy. All were unable to assist me, and about half suggested that I file my complaint with the State Department of Human Rights. I filed my complaint with the Department of Human Rights almost 1 year ago. My case is still waiting for review. The Human Rights Enforcement Officer has been gracious when I periodically contact him, but very honest with me about the unknown length of time it will take him to get to my case. The irony of all this is that as a social worker, I've spent a great deal of time supporting and advocating for my clients, yet in my time of need, I had no one. It has been a long time since the day that my mother died, and I felt the sting of being legally declared an orphan. But I was reminded of that as I tried over and over again to get assistance. This situation has been devastating. After working hard to obtain both my undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of Minnesota, and then working harder to obtain the highest level of licensure in my field, I have had difficulty obtaining full-time employment, especially in a position similar to the one I previously had in the educational system. I've had the humiliation and discomfort of answering questions from prospective employers about why I was let go. One of the employers even stating that the situation seemed highly unusual. I also had the humiliation of telling my son, who was in college right now and depending on my support, that I was let go from my job. All of the years of me telling him that hard work and integrity leads to success thick in the air between us. The little boy who once asked me if we were going to be rich when I told him that I had been accepted into the Master of Social Work program, now a young man telling me, it's okay, we'll get through this together. He is right, but we will need your assistance. The violation of my rights now means the violation of another person's rights later. The boldness of the inequitable treatment that I endured is telling, and that there seemed to be no fear of accountability. In times of turmoil, we look to our leaders for guidance and answers. However, as leaders, I realize that you need support as well. So I leave you with this quote that I reflect on whenever I am faced with difficult situation or circumstance. It is a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt.
You must do the thing which you think you cannot do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin, for your testimony. Representative Mullery, did you have a question of the testifiers, or can you wait till everyone testifies? Okay, very good. Please introduce yourself for the record, sir.
Dear Mr. Chairman, my name is Amar Berhe. I'm a founder and owner of ABA Tax Accounting. I reside at 10670 Hawthorne Trail, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55129, with my wife, Wayne Teclat, and with my children, age 17, 16, 14 years old. Mr. Chairman, as a concerned citizen, I support human rights expansion of Department of Rights duties. I'm grateful for an opportunity to speak to you today concerning the Council on Blacks Minnesota legislative proposal to increase duties and funding of the Department of Human Rights. To explain and strengthen why I strongly support the suggested proposal, I am going to submit my personal experience as follows. Mr. Chairman, my story exemplifies hundreds, perhaps thousands of women and minority business owners and entrepreneurs. My story begins July 2013 when I was contacted by a company located among us in the Twin Cities to provide a fee structure for outsourced general accounting service. I honestly believe the company was trying to get the best deal for their accounting needs. With no hesitation, I believe they were negotiating in good faith for their needs of general accounting service. We had several phone calls back and forth, meetings, and very carefully worded emails from July 26, 2013 until February 2014. This company deception came to light when I was invited to attend their bid award ceremony from Minnesota Sports Facility Authorities by claiming they would award more than 50% of their non-premium revenue associated with the project to two minority and women-owned business enterprises, one of those selected supposedly my company known as ABA Tax Accounting. Shortly after being awarded by putting my company as minority-owned partner, they decided not to utilize my service. Thus, they fired my company before they hired. That contracting and bidding process by the company adversely affected my trust in the American dream, the land of equal opportunity. It has shaken my confidence. This company never disclosed the material fact. In fact, they did everything to hide, and they indicated to me it was supposed to be secret. This is true prior to being awarded the contract, but there was not a bit of effort to show transparency to the very partner who, as minority business, may have factored in the decision of them being awarded the contract in the first place. This company failed to provide procedures to ensure that, as a subcontractor, made good effort to provide equal opportunity to me as minority business enterprise in the Viking Stadium project. In fact, they did everything in their power to hinder King Stadium project. In fact, they did everything in their power to hinder fair participation process in public contract. As a contractor, in my opinion, they failed to make pre-solicitation or pre-bid disclosure, both orally and in writing. In fact, they made great effort to hide this project. By their action, the company has failed to promote increased participation by qualified minority and women-owned businesses, and thus failed to provide an opportunity to participate in the public infrastructure project contracting. It is very clear the company used my company MBE status as a token to confuse the Sport Commission in awarding them a contract on the basis of false image of their company as supporter of minority-owned businesses. The fake image that helped them win the contract has now been shattered as they did not take time to slip back to their real image and fire my company soon after. This has put my company image in a dustbin with incalculable economic damages. Beyond this, however, it is not difficult to assume that this pattern followed by many similar undisciplined companies taking similar advantage of hundreds, perhaps thousands of unsuspecting minority or women-owned companies all over the state. Yes, Mr. Chairman, their effort gets a fee code structure was a fiasco and deserves legal action. But as a small business owner with three kids, I cannot afford to hire an attorney. And for sure, the company knew from the get-go that I cannot afford to bring legal or other action to ascertain my rights and the rights of my family. Therefore, it is very important to have a strong organization like Human Rights Commission, which oversee and protect the interests of minorities, women, and in general, disadvantaged citizens of the state to have fair participation within the system, to ensure the system of fairness and equitability from political and economic resources, as well as the policies and procedures of the state of Minnesota. I respectfully urge you to support this human rights bill. Thank you for your support, and I am very grateful for the opportunity to tell my story.
Thank you, Mr. Berhe. We have a couple of questions. I'm not sure who they're to, but Representative Mueller, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know Representative Hornstein likes to promote his constituents, but you're incorrect on who really was the instigator for the first in the nation civil rights and housing. It was my close friend and fellow Northsider, Nellie Stone Johnson, who is given credit by everyone for instigating the first in the nation in Minneapolis and then the first in the nation for the state. So now that we've got cleared who the north side is up here, I want
to... Mr. Chairman, I have to give a shout out to Josie Johnson, my constituent, who's also...
You can say that because Nellie's dead and can't come back and get you. You wouldn't say that if she was alive.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, I've been the leader on state contracting with minority businesses for about a decade and work really closely with the National Association of Minority Contractors. And I've got a bill working with them that's coming up next Tuesday. So anybody that's interested in that part of your bill, I hope they come and support it next Tuesday at 10 a.m. In government ops. But there is a and your 1.16 and 1.7. I think that we need to go further into this, and I'll go as you progress. I've spent hundreds of hours on this issue of minority contracting, and what we really need is some money from a certain chairman of the Transportation Committee for enforcement officers at DOT, and then we need it from, I've been fighting for this for years, we can't enforce things without enforcement officers, giving people assignments to do something and then not having them, anybody to do it doesn't work, and this is going back for close to 8 years that I've been fighting for more. And we also need them in admin and MNSCU, so I hope the author will help me, and he can help especially with one of those departments on getting enforcement officers right in there, because they're in there when the contracts are being done. And it really, I've talked to various people in the Human Rights Department, and they've said that we really need it in the agencies involved that are right there when the contract's being done. And that's the way to do it. So as we go forward, I hope we can work together on really getting something effective and not just passing another law. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I completely agree with you, Representative Mullery. And, you know, there's been an audit done of MnDOT that was released last summer, and Senator Dibble and I have been going back and forth with MnDOT about this very issue. So if there is a need for legislation, I'd be very happy to work with you on that.
Just real quick, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just basic legislation isn't needed. We got enough legislation. We need to put the money into enforcing what we have. Thank you.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions would be directed to Representative Hornstein. On line 1.11 in your bill, I'm really concerned, Representative, about the scope of those particular audit procedures on this. It states that they would implement audit procedures for state agencies, local areas of government, school districts, corporations, and institutions. And let me preface that by saying that I agree with the human rights proposals that this great state and great country have put forth over the last years, and it's very, very important. But I'd like you to give some consideration to the scope of that and the unfunded mandates for instance, school districts and local units of government. I have no idea, and I'm sure maybe we haven't thought too much about the cost of these audits, the number of people that would be involved, how they would be conducted. And, you know, for instance, like when you say local units of government, are we talking cities, counties, watershed districts, townships, and other people like that? It seems quite broad to me. And then corporations, Representative, you know, we have corporations that are family farms, Wells, Minnesota, and we have small corporations that are family corporations. Would these be included in these audits? And the other question I have is institutions. What is the definition there in terms of institutions?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uglem, I'm going to have Mr. McDonald come up from the Council on Black Minnesotans and, you know, address some of those issues specifically. But I just want the committee to know that, you know, these are the very kinds of institutions that need to be, you know, involved in this whole process. This is the list. Many of them are already engaged with the Department of Human Rights. So this is just an effort to, you know, tighten up the auditing procedures. And Mr. Chairman and representatives, this is an informational hearing for the very purpose to get some of these questions out on the table and work through them with you. But I'm going to have Mr. McDonald address some of your specific concerns about the various institutions involved.
Mr. McDonald, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Paymar, Representative. Thank you for that important question. As we contemplated the development of this piece of legislation, one of the things that we gauged is the how the complaint-based system is pretty much had its day. It still needs to be in place, but there is a need for us to be a little bit more proactive in ensuring the administrative applications of those protections, civil rights and equal opportunity laws, which all intersect with all institutions and all systems within our society. What we have today are people that don't take serious the administrative application of those laws. They are a direct contributor to the growing disparities that exist within our communities, be it education system, local government contracting, state contracting, underutilization of qualified professionals in the managerial operations of state departments, you name it. And quite frankly, today there are people who take on the title of Equal Opportunity Compliance Officer or Affirmative Action Officer who know that because the state has not funded its human rights department, or at least a net increase in funding for the past 20 years, that it takes 3 to 4 years for a complaint to be investigated, they will make that decision to discriminate against a person. And when they discriminate, they know that there is less likely an opportunity that that complaint would ever get resolved within 3 to 4 or 5 years. But the person like Ms. Tamara walks away completely destroyed. We're saying we need to turn the spotlight on those institutions for two reasons. One, expose those who have that kind of intent in their heart. Secondly, to quantify what those institutions are doing right and provide the quantitative information to take corrective actions on things that they're not doing right. At the end of the day, as citizens of Minnesota, as Americans, as humans, we just want all of our institutions and systems to be fair and open. I think we've come to a point in our existence with the administrative application of civil rights and equal opportunity laws to ensure through proactive engagement that those institutions, local governments, and corporations get it, that this is an important piece of the puzzle to move us towards eradicating disparities.
Mr. McDonald, I need you to introduce yourself for the tape, I'm told, so sorry.
Representative Paymar, my name is Edward McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the State Council on Black Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we all, everybody, agree with the overall ideas of the Human Rights Department and everything else. But I am just saying that, for instance, the way this is written, a township, and we have many, many townships in the state of Minnesota, you know, are they going to be looking at or being included in this, and what will the cost be to local units of government? I used to be a mayor in the city of Champlin, and of course we had a human rights officer, a person that worked that way, and everything else. But some of the smaller units of government, the watershed districts, for example, of which there are thousands of them throughout Minnesota, the scope of this, I think we have to take a look at, and we have to look at the unfunded mandates and the cost to some of these smaller local units of government also. And we all agree that there's a lot of room for improvement with a lot of institutions. But again, the way this is written, I mean, does this include the Minneapolis Swedish Institute, you know, or the Sons of Norway or whatever? That type of thing I think we have to zero in on if we're going to be really developing a bill that will benefit everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I clearly understand, and I guess what we try to reconcile is what is the price for unfairness? What we see today is opportunities slipping away from certain segments of the community. And I think we hold true this fact, that in Minnesota, the human stories may be singular, but our destiny is shared. We rise or fall as one people and as one state. And through this legislation, we think the power of human unity prevails. Now, I understand the complications of deploying auditing-type systems in order to create fairness. And we believe there are mechanisms and ways that this can be done. Those that those laws intersect with need to be examined in order to ensure that that fairness come through. That's how we're going to be able to move this community to the next level. There's 68 human rights commissions around the state, which tells me that counties across this state, this great state, recognize that this is an important part of the heritage, the culture, and traditions of this great state. And we're at a crossroad. Where do we take it? Time have said the way we do things now have stalled progress. As the speaker said here, we know in our community we can do better. But there are these barriers that are there that keep us from growing our economic contributions, our cultural contributions to this community. We don't want to be the burden or disproportionately represented in correctional institutions. We want to be in higher education institutions. There's so many things right now in the system that is erecting these barriers that need to be discovered, lowered, so that our community can continue to excel and contribute to this great state. And we think auditing is one part of that.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong. We sat here last spring, and wasn't the Human Rights Department, wasn't their budget doubled? I would like to see, or I knew there was a substantial increase. I could be wrong on this, but it seems to me that the folks
Representative Newberg, we did add two positions and up and did some technology upgrades, if I'm not mistaken. But it wasn't very much.
I would like to see what the budget was. I don't have that off the top of my head, but if I recall correctly, one of the things that seemed to jump out from last spring was that there was a twofold increase that we saw in that department. Just so I might be wrong, I'm not gonna sit here and say that I'm. But it seems to me that when we had the man in charge was here, that was one of the things that we went through with this budget. In order for them to carry out their work more efficiently and effectively, they deemed that they needed to be bigger. The other concern that I have echoes here with how this would reach into school districts, and this would be for Representative Hornstein. Have you spoken to any of the school district leadership people and superintendents to ask them what is their current burden right now for compliance for state or federal guidelines? I have family members who work for school districts. I have 9 school districts that are currently in my legislative district, and the amount of bureaucratic, administrative, and legislative work that they already have to do, it seems like here we are adding another layer, and we're also looking at instituting school climate centers should the legislative process unfold the way some people think it's going to. We're looking here at our schools in particular becoming more and more institutions of less of learning and more of anything but. So I guess that was a long question, but Representative Hornstein, have you spoken to any of the school superintendents, any of the people in the educational system? Have you talked to the teachers' unions? Have you talked to anyone on those ends asking them what their opinion was on this?
Representative Hornstein, and then we have one more bill, members, and I know you've been very patient, and we want to try to get through that too, and so if we can sort of wrap up here.
Sure, I'll be very quick.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Neuberger, thanks for the question. You know, of course, education and schools have been, when you talk about the history of the civil rights movement, this has been at the forefront. And yes, some of these institutions that you mentioned have been consulted. I know that the teachers' unions have been. We've discussed this. We have a school principal here, so she's been consulted. But I'm going to ask Mr. McDonald to get into some of the more specifics in terms of, you know, the different education stakeholders that have been involved in this. So thank you for the question.
Mr. McDonald, if you could make it brief, because there's some people in the audience who want to speak to the bill, too, this one.
Representative Paymar, Representative, we toured the state of Minnesota, particularly population centers where there are large populations of African heritage people. Those focus group discussions and our surveying include a broad swath of folks who were involved in our deliberations, as well as responding to survey questions about this piece of legislation. They also engaged in actively in helping us to craft the legislation. One of the things that some of the districts don't have is the ability to look at how they are faring with the administrative application of civil rights and equal opportunity laws, particularly when you look at our special education area and the number of children disproportionately of color that are being tracked into that. Many would like to explore if they are in compliance with the IDEA Act of 2004. Equipping our State Department with the ability to go in through state agencies and local governments to be able to help them with examining the extent to which the poor administrative application of equal access and opportunity laws are contributing to disparities in a lot of areas, including education, becomes important quantitative information to collect in order for them to plan to take corrective action. And so while we know that this is a new direction, it moves us, it grows our ability around a complaint-based system. The way we see it, as folks who DNA and heritage in this movement from abolitionists to civil rights, it has become the next step. Even with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, there were people who were determined to defeat it and reverse it, and that happens even to this day. We think the regression in funding for it, both at the federal and state level, have afforded that opposition the opportunity to infuse themselves inside of institutions and corporations and, in fact, win on some of these things. And we're saying that if we are going to advance our community, auditing has to be one of those pieces, plus the other components that are inside of here. I can't think of a better state with its history than Minnesota to lead the nation again around the implementation and strengthening of civil rights and equal access and opportunity laws. Minnesota has been a national leader. You know, our history is rich in that tradition. The cultural foundation of the people who settled here have always been a national leader, and I think moving this bill forward, particularly the pieces that deal with how do we domesticate the United Nations treaties. We want a study committee on that to look at how we can deploy the covenant to end racial discrimination or women's rights, housing rights. Are we ready to move in that direction? I think Minnesota is. And I think that we have always been a leader, including Democrats and Republicans. Nobody mentioned Governor LeVander, who was the governor, a Republican governor, that created the first state office on human rights here in Minnesota. And Wendell Anderson, arguably one of the more popular governors who led the nation with the establishment of affirmative action laws. So this piece of legislation builds off of that tradition and moves us and make us a national leader again in human rights enforcement.
Representative Cornish, did you have a question or comment?
Representative Paymar, this bill, you put us in a tough spot here because we don't want to vote against the bill because we don't want to look like we're against racial disparity and everything about it, but this bill is a logistical and bureaucratic nightmare. I don't mean that in a bad way, but just look, this would take Mr. Wallace a week with three assistants to figure out the fiscal note on this, its implications. It's a two-page bill, but it covers 100 things, and as soon as these user groups start to hear about this, in the districts and everybody that's going to have to comply with this, and a fiscal note starts to be put together, it's unbelievably huge. And we got a human rights commission right now, or a department that isn't really doing its job, as to the testimony, and they're going to need funding. And so this fiscal note is going to be out of this world.
Representative Cornish, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill if we can work some things out that are satisfactory. It will be in the omnibus bill, and Mr. McDonald knows that if not, we will take this up in the next biennial discussions. So I've already had this communication with Mr. McDonald. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson and I were just doing the quick math off of the reports here. According to what we were able to discern, it looks like the Human Rights Department did have a $112 million increase last year, from last year's budget.
No.
That's what we were pulling off the internet here. So that's just what we were able to find. We could be wrong. If I am, I will stand corrected. But at this point, the public information that we have shows about $112 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Waltz is going to provide the committee with the
That'll be nice. And if I'm wrong, I'll be the first one to say, but that's what we're pulling off of the information that we've got, at the public information. So thank you.
Mr. McDonald, real quickly, we have some other people.
Mr. Chair, the amount of money allocated in the biennium budget for human rights last year was an additional $200,000. their annual budget have been fixed for the past 15 years around $6 million for each biennium since, I think, 1998. So the increase was really just an adjustment to stave off losing two staff members. And you can speak to them directly, but our analysis of it show that there's been no net increase in funding since 1998, and the budget had been set each biennium at about $6 million. $200,000 was allocated last year in the biennium to save some affirmative action officers.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McDonald, Ms. Dr. Lawson, Mr. Burhe, Ms. Martin, for your testimony. Representative Hornstein, there's still, I want to ask if there's anyone else from the community or from the audience that wants to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill. Okay, please come up and keep your comments short. We still have another bill, and we're supposed to quit here at 11:30, and we're going to keep going until everyone has an opportunity. But
Mr. Chair, I'm going to need to.
You have to leave
out as well. Is that
okay? Representative Hornstein, okay. Thank you for presenting your bill. We'll lay it over.
I want to thank you so much, members of the committee, and for your questions.
Okay, please introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Jones.
Chairman Paymer, this is Michael. I'm Michael Jones. I'm with Minnesota Parent Child Advocacy Center in North Minneapolis. I support this bill we need to have oversight. I want to give you two examples that I've had when I was working as an intern in Representative Jefferson's office in 1990. The first one was out-of-home placements. At that time, the law was that we had the Minority Heritage Act. Well, I served with the Council on Black Minnesotans reviewing out-of-home placements with the State Department. And while I wasn't concerned about minority placement, I was concerned about the fact that this state was in violation of a 10-year-old at the time Supreme Court decision, Miller v. Yoakum, which said it was illegal not to include relatives in the foster care program. And in 1990, the state of Minnesota had never changed its laws, and it was still illegal to license relatives in the foster care program. The other component of that law was that if they didn't license relatives, that they would have an approval process. And the state had no approval process. I then went on to work with the Department of Human Services to write an instructional bulletin, which took a year. And at the end of that year, we had the instructional bulletin ready, and no one was ready to implement it. So I asked to speak with the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, who promptly declined. And then Representative Jefferson, I think it was committee chair of the House Human Services Committee, and said, well, call her up and tell her I want to meet with her. They then, I did so. The commissioner said, we will talk to him ourselves. I gave him promptly his phone number. We had the meeting the next day. And the commissioner said in the meeting, we're going to implement the bulletin within days, not months. 3 days later, this was in November of 1991, that instructional bulletin was issued, and the entire sea changed in Minnesota in terms of out-of-home placements. Oversight. We have to have it. A fundamental civil right violation of a child is not to be in the least restrictive setting when the state finds for their own best interest we have to remove that kid in an emergency. This is a fundamental right. And when the state takes you either for protection, like in a child protection matter, or criminal before you have legal rights. These are civil rights. We were in this situation 10 years after the Supreme Court decision because we didn't have any enforcement and oversight. Another example of this is on 72-hour holds. And this was another bill that I helped work with
Mr. Jones, and I have to ask you to
okay.
Because we're going to lose the committee, and there's another bill to be heard. So I, you know, it's just unfortunately, I was told we had a half hour for the both bills, and okay. It's now going into an hour. So if you could just try to wrap it up.
Kids had a right to be placed on a 72-hour hold in with relatives in a 72-hour hold, health and welfare hold. Department to this day has not enforced that action ever, even though the legislature put language in there in 1996 that said that removed it from a may place to a shall place, and it has not ever happened. Again, this gets back to civil rights being in the least restrictive setting in all processes. We have to have mechanisms that bring this up for review, and then we have enforcement action.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Nick Muhammad. Thank you, Chair. Chair Pamar. I just want you all to consider three things as you look at this bill. I understand the bureaucratic impact that it'll take, but we also have to consider the consequences of what, you know, inaction is going to produce. And the reality of the matter is there are several different Minnesotas for several different constituencies and demographic groups in the state. And this is not something that is uncommon. In fact, the president is here to, you know, promote and campaign around issues to solve some of these disparities. And even though it might seem expensive up front, the long-term implications is what we need to consider. There's been plenty of reports that are showing that not only America and Minnesota is browning, and that browning means that there's going to be an increase in the presence of minority groups. And either we fortify ourselves and build the infrastructure necessary to handle that transfer and inclusion of these groups in our political process, in our communities, in our business communities, or we sit and we wait until it's upon us and we end up with a lot of historical references that, you know, we probably don't want to repeat. So in a nutshell, I liken this to similarly to some of the issues that were brought up earlier in the earlier bills around victimization and the expectation of justice. When you don't have anywhere to go, when you are racially discriminated against, and even in this panel, there's no diversity that we can see outside of gender. And when you're a person of color and you walk into a room and the expectation of justice is not there, as an American and as a Minnesotan, that is wrong. And we have to take accountability for that through actions of supporting bills like this. And I understand the cost, dollars-wise, but we also have to consider when we're looking at the disparities in education, in the disproportionate representation inside of the prison system, and when it comes down to employment, this measure should have been taken a very long time ago. And that's all I want you all to consider as you think about this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Muhammad. Next.
Chairperson Pamar and representatives, my name is Carrie Felder, and as I was sitting there, I was looking around at the people behind me, and I just want you to take the people that you see and multiply that times tens of thousands, because we all represent multiple organizations, whether they be religious organizations, union, community organizations. Those are the people that we have in this room today. It's very hard to come and fight for your rights during the daytime when people are at work. And so I do hope that you take that into consideration as you take a look at this law. Also, being partly Norwegian, if the sons of Norway have to be included, then I think that that's fine. When I was younger, I couldn't ride in the float, but now they've changed the float criterion for people of color to be on it on the Central Avenue parade. I also would like to just let you know that the St. Paul Federation of Teachers is very proud of the fact that they have raised the percentage of students graduating in St. Paul. So I do want to give a heads up to our education factors here in Minnesota. I think Minnesota is leaders in many things, and for us not to take the lead in this really sets a very sad example for the rest of the nation.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Felder.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Dora Jones. I am the executive director of an organization called Mentoring Young Adults. I am in support of this bill. but I'm also saddened by this bill. It's sad that we are still, again, in 2014, steady fighting for human rights and civil rights in this country, not just the great state of Minnesota. I am very saddened that we are still here again trying to make people accountable to America to do the right thing. So I'm asking you to please, please understand how important moving this agenda and this bill forward, how it will not only change the course that we're on right now, but it also continues to give us that support that we've been fighting for so many years. We should not still be fighting for human rights. We have a fundamental right to get it right. Not just you sitting there to pass this bill, but everybody in this room. We gotta start getting stuff right. We can do better, people. I'm not just talking about us in my African American community, I'm also talking about you. We can do better. So let's do better, please. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Jones. Next.
Hi. My name is Jamila Thomas. I echo the sentiments of everybody that was here. I also would like to say that I am in support of this bill and everything that is in it. I was a little offended when it came up to cost, because as I listened to the other bills, cost was not a factor that was mentioned by some of the committee members. One of the things that I personally want to address and why it's important for human rights, but also why it's important for you guys to take this bill in consideration and why we need accountability, is because one of the places that I work for, and especially when the context comes into special needs and children of color, we aren't represented. And as Mr. Muhammad stated before, there is no one here that represents us of people of color. There was, there was the Race Relations Act of 1976, which was amended, which also included talking about harassment. There's different forms of discrimination. And this, if you don't enact this bill, we will also be in that consideration as well. It's important for me as a parent, it's important for me as an advocate, it's important for me as a woman of color, it's important for me as a citizen, that this bill not only be supported, but not be bogged down by how much it will cost to different communities. The biggest cost would be what it will cost our kids when we are actually gone. So I would like you to consider this bill and consider the other bills coming forward as a way to make changes in Minnesota and what we can do better for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Thomas. Anybody else? Okay, then we will lay this bill over, and I thank you all for your testimony. Having been on this committee for many years, the issues with the Department of Human Rights are not new. We know what they are. We know there's been funding issues in the past. We know there should be additional funding. There's delays in cases that have been. There's a long history with the department, and that's partially a funding issue. We know that there's a small number of cases where probable cause is actually found. We know of the problem, and I think Mr. McDonald, I appreciate that you have put the bill together, you and others on the Council on Black Minnesotans, and I don't want it to fall away, and I hope that we can work on some language that might be acceptable to the committee, and we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill. So with that, we will take up House File 1929, Representative Dean. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members who have stayed here through all of this. We will try to be as brief as we can. So the bill 1929 is requesting that we have a sentencing disparity study. I think we all operate under a lot of anecdotal evidence around what happens regards to sentencing in people of color and race and issues like that. And what we're requesting is that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission conduct a study and requiring county attorneys as well as public defenders to gather racial data that's related to sentencing recommendations for each defendant represented by an attorney in that office. and then it goes through and outlines several things that are requested. Ultimately, I have met with the executive director of the Sentencing Guideline Commission, and we're going to do some work regarding a couple of these dates, because if we did this as this bill stated, we're asking for a report at the end of December of this year, which means we'd have a very, very small data set. So I'll be speaking with her as well as the advocates, and ultimately I think what we're going to do is request that they collect the data through the end of the year, and then they report back to the legislature before the end of session next year, so that we can then look at that data, look at the and analyze what is going on, and then hopefully in 2016 come back with some proposed legislation.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. And your testifiers?
Yes. I will now turn it over to the testifiers. To my right is Donovan Bailey with the Council on Black Minnesotans.
Mr. Bailey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Donovan Bailey. I'm a board member on the Council on Black Minnesotans and also serve as secretary, criminal justice chair, and Rochester committee chair.
Welcome.
Chairman Paymar, it is a great privilege to be here with you and your distinguished committee in regards to this bill, HF 1929. I have had the privilege of serving the state as a police officer in many correctional and therapeutic type of programs, and currently I work as a dispositional advisor for the Public Defender's Office of the 3rd District. As well, as you know, I am part of the Council on Black Minnesotans and its Criminal Justice Committee. My comments will be brief, and I want to lean on the comments of our chair, of our executive director and our vice chair, who spoke so eloquently to the issues before you. Allow me just to be passionate and brief. Working in the Public Defender's Office and in the capacities that I have in the avenue of criminal justice, disparities in the criminal justice system is where we see it the most. The collateral consequences of such, the issues of public safety, this is a real issue for the state. And I want to implore this committee to consider this issue and begin to move forward on this simple legislation to begin to track this. This is a great state. This is an awesome state. I'm from the state of Indiana and moved here, and I know this to be an awesome state. But a stain on this nation, and definitely in this state, given the statistics of us being one of the highest in disproportionality, is the issue of disparities in the criminal justice system. What we're asking today is that this distinguished committee move forward and begin to survey this with our public defender department, as mentioned, with our prosecutors, and also with the DLC department. We want to get a study done so we can look at the issue of disparities and come up with some solutions for you all and our other people to consider to move forward on disparities. Consider it this way. When you think of the issue of public safety, collateral consequences, Minnesota cannot afford, being the great state that it is, to not finally deal with this issue of disparities. As I go across all the courtrooms of South Minnesota where I work, disparity is the elephant in the room. Admittedly, it's a difficult issue to deal with, but we have to deal with it if we want to continue to be the great state of Minnesota. It's a simple ask that we put before you, and I ask that you pass this bill, HF 1929. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again, sir. And my fellow members, thank you very much. My name is VJ Smith. I am the national president of Mad Dads, which stands for Men Against Destruction, Defending Against Drugs and Social Disorder. I support this bill for a number of reasons, HF 1929. Number one is because our young men and women are not coming out prepared. They're simply not coming out prepared. And as a individual that used to be a problem to your state, which is now turning other people's lives around and being a contribution to your state, I see the problem every day. And I want to use, for example, I have Michael. He's our janitor at our office. And Michael's only able to come and clean our office, but he's not able to do what he could do best, and that's reach out to the community and make a difference. That's simply because probation and others won't allow him to do that. But would they, if they would talk to me, or if they allow me to have impact on that, I can make a difference, not only in Michael's life as a father, but as a contributor to this community. Also, I want to use an example of Alonzo. Alonzo, a young man that has had troubled life and turned his life around from crack and everything else, but because of the system not allowing him to do the things he do, he is working with me, and he's doing a great job, but he could do much more. But I want to say to Alonzo, he's sitting right here, Alonzo, I'm proud of you, sir, that the work that you're doing out in the community to change others' lives. If we collect this information, it's going to be important for us to see exactly what's going on and how the community can help you, because we need to help you. We're on the ground. We got our boots on the ground. We know what's going on. We know we can help you if you allow us to collect this information in a way so we can collect it by race and find out what's going on, not only with African Americans, Latinos, and others in the community, so we can look at that and say, what can we do better? What can we do different? Also, expungements. It's important that we look at expungements. We have people running around with sexual offenses. They happened when they were 14. Now they're 35 years old and still hung over their heads. They can't get jobs and opportunities. We've got to do a better job in that. And then the other thing is that we've got to educate these clients on how to be successful. The resources just aren't there. And with this study, that will make that happen. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Again, my name is Dora Jones. I'm the founder and executive director of an organization called Mentoring Young Adults. If you don't mind, I would just like to ask Wayne Lindsay to come down and stand with me on this, on my brief testimony, please. This is a very touching situation to our community when we talk about reentry back into society. I'm going to give you a quick example of a young man by the name of Mr. Walter Ray Womack. He got 21 years in custody at the age of 20 years old. He has just come home, and he has never worked a job. And his parole officer was requesting that he find a job within 2 weeks or he's going back to prison. That's absolutely crazy to me. So what we have to do in the course of doing my job, we have to train them and transition them back into society by changing the way they think. This young man that I've asked to come stand with me, Wayne Lindsay, just got home and has returned to society, has never worked a job, but we have to get him ready to transition back into society because we don't want him to go back to the penal system. I can sit here today and tell you so many things that is wrong with our correction system, but I'm just going to ask you to please move this bill forward because we need to really work on trying to help transition our men back into society so they can be productive citizens. We can't keep sending them back to jail because with that, we're losing our fathers. We're losing our men to raise men. It's detrimental to our community that we do the best we can to change the way these men think, to bring them back home and get them transitioning back into society. So please, I'm asking you to do the best you can. We are accountable to everybody. And I want Wayne to just introduce himself and maybe say a brief word so that we can begin to settle in and understand this problem we have with the justice system. Thank you.
Sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Wayne Lindsay, and it's been a long transition, but it's going well. First time being in this building since I was in elementary, so it's definitely a good feeling. And working with young men and young women in my community, it's time I give back to my community, so I look forward to doing it, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else that wishes to speak in support or in opposition to this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Mullery, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do notice, Representative Dean, that there's no money assigned to this, and I've tried to do this exact thing in the past, and I just got astronomical figures. I was trying to do it with, actually, Department of Education. They all do studies of just numbers, but they don't go back into why did some decision be made, and my understanding is that's the intent of this bill is to find out for each thing why a decision was made at each level, which I think is exactly what is needed, because until we know that, we don't know what policies or what problems there are. But public safety, education, in the past, when I talked to Guidelines Commission, they said that would be too costly. So I don't know if you have numbers, but unless they've changed their mind, we're going to need quite a bit of money in here for this for the chairman. So have you gotten them to waive the extra cost of this? Because if we do it thoroughly without a pilot programs, it's going to be pretty costly from what I've been told in the past.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we have not gotten a fiscal note yet. As I believe this is just an informational hearing today, so there are a few things that we will try to get resolved and get clarified as we move forward onto the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, that's where the bill currently is in the Judiciary Committee. Okay, very good. Sir?
If I may add, Donovan Bailey with the Council of Black Minnesotans, Chairman Paymar, understanding that there needs to be a budget for this, and it needs to be a very competent budget. Please understand the collateral consequences of the budget on the back end if we don't get in front of this. We really need to see how the collateral consequences and how the state of Minnesota is paying on the back end of these issues. So as we think about that and formulate a plan budgetary-wise, please understand something on the front end like this will save the state of Minnesota a lot of money on the back end.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. Mr. Bailey, I've been trying that for years to argue that, and so far I haven't succeeded, so I'm certainly pushing this as hard. And if we can't get this statewide, I hope you'll, because of actual costs, I hope we can at least get some pilots around targeted areas, at least to start with, and then maybe in a bigger budget year, expand that.
So Cornish?
Just real quickly to the lady that took offense to the bringing up the finances. The reason it is, we're behind you in a lot of your requests here in theory, but you have to realize our plight too. I mean, we are told if we don't fix Highway 14, people are going to die. If we don't put money into education, kids are going to go to prison. If we don't make after-prison programs, people are going to go back to prison. If we don't put money into health care, people are going to die. And so everything that we do to switch money around is really important to us. So if we take money to put in your program, we short somebody else. And that's the reason I brought that up. There is a limit to resources and how much we can do, and it's just prioritization. It's not that we don't believe in your cause, everybody out there. So,
okay, you'll get the last word.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And please, no disrespect to this chair or to the body. Again, my name is Dora Jones, Executive Director of Mentoring Young Adults. I find it highly suspect that every time we try to do something to create change in our community, there's always no money. I find it highly suspect that every time we need to get something done that creates a better Minnesota, we find the money. So by being on the end of this totem pole, we need to start uplifting from the bottom, putting money on the bottom and uplifting that way. I've never seen a tree change its leaves from the top down. You have to plant the root, and you have to put the money on the bottom so we can grow new trees and branch out in a changing fashion. So please, I love the state of Minnesota, but I think when everybody say great state, I think that's a little overrated, and I'm just being honest. I believe that we were such a great state, we wouldn't have so many disparities in every area, education, unemployment, housing, you name it. We are, African Americans are on the bottom. So I, as being an African-American woman, I love the state I live in, but I think we can do better. And when it comes to African-American people, we need to do better. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for your testimony. Representative Dean, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I know you're going to continue working on this. And with that, thank you, members who stayed, for your patience for going way over time. This meeting's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.